Well, it takes a very special person to be a mediator in this day and age. They need to be trustworthy so that both sides are feeling open to be able to talk freely. They need to be approachable. They need to be empathetic, dedicated, perceptive to see all the different angles. But most importantly, they need to be impartial, to be able to stand in the gap well. Whenever it became clear in Northern Ireland, after 30 or more long years of the Troubles, there was this moment, a window of opportunity, where it seemed possible to enter in to peace talks. And the government enlisted the help of mediators, people that were respected enough from both sides of the community to stand in the gap. And so they chose members of clergy to act as mediators. One was a priest, and the other was a Presbyterian minister, Reverend Dr. Ken Newell. And Ken would tell me the story of what it was like to be a mediator. The IRA would come to his house. They would put him in a van. They would put a sack over his head and put him in the back of the van so that he had no idea where he was going. And he was brought to the IRA place to negotiate peace with them. And through the help of mediators like Ken Newell, the Good Friday Agreement came to being in 1998. And 20 years on, we're still living in peace. It's fragile, it's tenuous, but Northern Ireland still has peace. But there's tremendous cost to being a mediator. Ken himself would acknowledge that. There were times Ken's own people, his own community, felt they were being sold out and betrayed by Ken. And one of the hardest repercussions was to his own family. I remember him telling me one of the hardest things was watching the impact it had on his own mother, as his own people would come with stones and throw stones through her window, her front window, because they felt betrayed by what Ken was doing. There's always a cost to peace. So why would you do that? Why would you be a mediator? Why did Ken do that and stand in the gap? Well, Ken's sense of calling to be a peacemaker in his own community didn't happen in 1998, but it happened in the early 70s. He was a missionary in Timor in Indonesia. He had come home after serving there. And he remembers a moment when he was sitting in a car in Belfast when one of the bombs exploded, killing many. And he remembers sitting in the car simply saying, "Lord, what do you want me to do with this? What do you want me to do?" And that was the start of Ken Newell's calling of simple surrender to God's will. When Hebrews 5 talks about how mediators are chosen, our priests are chosen, it says, "No one elects himself to this honored position. He is called by God." Now, there's some universal qualities in Hebrews 5 that talks about the qualities every priest should have. But then it moves on to the special qualities of Jesus Christ. One of the first qualities is in verse 1, solidarity with your own people. When you have someone representing you, if you're going to court and you want to choose a lawyer, isn't it a comfort when you find out that that lawyer has been through exactly the same trials that you have been through, that they've sat where you've sat in your shoes? It makes all the difference to know that the person representing you has been in your place. That's why solidarity is so important. And verse 1 says, "A high priest is selected from among men in order to represent them in matters relating to God." I love that in COS here, whenever the preacher gets up to preach, they don't stand up on a pulpit 6 feet above contradiction, but that they emerge from the people. They sit amongst each other and they emerge to preach in order to show that they are rising out from a place where they identify with others. Solidarity. But then there's sympathy, verse 2 and 3. The high priest is able to deal sympathetically with people who wander away from their faith. Doesn't it make a difference to have a church fellowship where you know you can come back to no matter what has happened? You will be welcomed with open arms without that feeling of being judged. But there's a subtle description here. It says, those who are ignorant of going astray. In other words, sometimes people choose to leave a church very intentionally and they become hardened. But then there's another group of people who simply just drift away and don't even realize it. And these are the people the high priest is told to deal sympathetically and gently with, because it could so easily be one of us. This high priest draws near because it says he himself is subject to weakness. And this idea of weakness, the Greek describes like a millstone pulling someone down around their neck. Like everybody else, they get tired. Like everybody else, they get discouraged and weighed down with life. And yet, they experience grace that no matter what has happened, no matter what weakness they feel, no matter how we feel today, there is this grace that covers every stain. Well, as we describe these qualities of the high priest, I wonder if you're saying to yourself, well, that's understandable, that's perfectly achievable. I can check all these things off in my own being. We can feel near to these qualities. But as we move towards Jesus as the high priest and what he did, we move into deeper terrain. When we think of Jesus, the Son of God, becoming a high priest, I wonder if it struck you that he took his authority from God. He didn't take it from himself. Even though he was the Son of God, even though he had power, he took his authority from God. Verse 5, Christ did not take on himself the glory of becoming the high priest. And when you think of Jesus' status, he was the heir of the kingdom. And if you think about all the famous heirs in this world and how they get their inheritance, usually when a son who's an heir gets his inheritance, all he has to do is walk into his father's head office and take his seat, take on his new role. But for Jesus, it was different. It began when the Father chose him and selected him. That moment when he rose out from the waters of his baptism, when God's voice from heaven came down saying to him, "You are my son." You see, God was authorizing his son to use his power. Calvin said that one reason Jesus did this was not for Jesus' own benefit, but for our benefit, to show us how to sit under God's authority and submission. And if God authorized Jesus to use his power, then surely we need God's authority too. When we use power without a sense of authority or the right sense of authority, it becomes so dangerous. There's a study that was done in 2000 by Harvard Medical School saying that the most dangerous people in the world are the ones who have power but are so unaware of how to sit under authority and use it well, and so they transmit trauma generation after generation. It's that moment when your authority slips into entitlement. And you begin to say, I'm entitled to do these things. We say in our culture, no one's going to be the boss of me. Do you say that here? No one's going to be the boss of me. And don't insurance companies say the most dangerous moment in a driver's life is immediately after a young person gets their driving test? That's when all the accidents happen. Because all of a sudden they feel authorized to drive, but it so quickly slips into entitlement. David and I took our driving test for our Michigan driver's license just over a month ago, and I tell you, it took me back to when I was 17 years old. And I couldn't believe it. I've been driving for years, but I sat in the driver's seat and I was doing my parallel parking and my legs were shaking. But I passed the test, and it struck me just hours later, I was driving around Grand Rapids. I was confident. I had a feeling of entitlement. I felt everyone should give way to me because I've just passed my Michigan driver's license. But do you see how so easily we slip into that place of entitlement? That's what happened to the people of Korah in the Old Testament. They tried to become priests without God authorizing them. 250 people thought to themselves, we can do this. And they elevated themselves to priestly office and took control. Do you know what happened? God opened the earth and they were swallowed up. Because this kind of entitlement destroys church life. Verse 5 says, Christ did not take on himself the glory of becoming a high priest. God gave him the glory. And that's the difference, because even Jesus could be thankful for the divine glory that was given to him. The opposite of an entitled leader is a grateful leader, a leader who marvels at how God has given glory to them. And as gratitude shrinks, entitlement grows. And again, you might think, well, all this seems achievable, all of this seems good. But what happens when you are that high priest, when you are chosen by God and authorized to do a certain task, and it begins to feel hard? And you say to God, I didn't sign up for this. This is hard, hard work. When you no longer feel in control, when you're faced with problems you know you can't fix, you don't even understand the problems, well, that's the place where Jesus stood. That's the place where transformation happens. It says in verse 7, so powerfully, during the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with crying, with tears, to the one who could save him from death. This is the moment. This is the moment where Jesus took on the full authority and power of what he came to do. This is where he's unlike any other human heirs that naturally slip into their father's head office, because Jesus gained his inheritance by giving it up. He faced the pain of the cross, crying out, Lord, I just wish there was another way. Could you not save me? Take this cup of suffering away, yet not my will, but yours be done. And unlike all the other imperfect priests in the line of Aaron, who first sacrificed for themselves, Jesus put himself on the table as the perfect sacrifice. He would have loved another way. But he surrendered and said, Lord, let your will be done. And this is the moment of transformation, because it says, at this moment, Jesus learned obedience from what he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became the source of salvation. Now, I know some people struggle with that language, because it seems to suggest there was a moment when Christ wasn't perfect. And yet this is much more to do with how Jesus was moving through to the end, to the completion when God's plan would be played out by becoming the perfect sacrifice. He became the eternal source of salvation. He now opened up the permanent way for people to reach God without having to earn it for themselves. And there's something else going on here. There's a flash of a name. I wonder if you wondered about it. It says Jesus was designated by God to be the high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Now, what does that mean? Who was Melchizedek? Why is it important to name Melchizedek? This tiny figure in Genesis who was only appeared once in the entire Old Testament. He makes this small cameo role there. But Melchizedek was the king who was also the priest. There are two Psalms quoted in Hebrews 5. Verse 5 talks of Psalm 2, which is all about Jesus wearing the crown, being appointed to be the king. And then in the next verse, Psalm 110 is quoted, which talks about Jesus not being like a king, but being like the priest. And this is the first time that these two ideas are brought together, the king and the priest made perfect in Jesus Christ. Does that matter to you today? Does it really matter that we put Jesus as son, king, priest all together? Well, if you think about the qualities of these two roles, all the qualities of a king are to do with power, justice, rule, governance. But you would never dare approach a king's throne unless they invited you to come. And then when you think about the qualities of a priest, it's someone who is your sympathizer, who stands in solidarity with you and will approach the king on your behalf and make peace for you. And when you put these two ideas together of king and priest, you've someone who's full of truth and wisdom and justice, but someone who's soft enough to understand your tears, to understand the pain of Gethsemane, to sit with you in the dark places of your life and help you find a way through. This is the place where man should have stood, but only God could. He was the Son, the King, and priest, and united all these ideas to bring about transformation. Here's an illustration of what it looks like. I love Mary and Martha, those two sisters. And Dick Lucas, the preacher from London, tells the story of how Jesus interacted with them both according to what they needed. Lazarus has died, and his two sisters, Mary and Martha, are coming out to meet Jesus. And they both say the same thing, but Jesus deals with them differently. First of all, Martha comes out and says to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And Jesus puts his kingly hat on and confronts Martha with the truth. "Martha, I'm the resurrection and the life. In other words, don't you believe the truth of who I am?" But when Mary comes out and says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died," what does Jesus do? He cries. He doesn't say a word. He simply stands with Mary in her tears. He gets involved in her pain. And in this story, you have a picture of the Messiah, who is on the one hand king, who knows the truth that will set us free, but he's also the high priest, the one who's prepared to weep the tears along with us and understand agony. He gets down to the depths of our pain and in his perfect love stands with us. And that's what it means to be a priest in the order of Melchizedek, uniting truth and grace, uniting love and justice, uniting mercy and salvation together to bring about resurrection. What will it take for us to get to that place today, where the beautiful Sun King Priest stands with us, fully alive in who we are and how we live? Well, in another place, Jesus said, "The only sign I give you in life is the sign of Jonah." Isn't that striking? Because sometimes you need to go to the belly of the beast to understand these things, because it's in the belly of the beast, like Jonah, where you sit there and you realize, I can't be my own savior. Oh, how we love to try and understand and analyze and fix people and solve their problems. How we love to be in control. But maybe God is calling you to accept the different way. That when we say yes to God, that almost certainly means saying yes to suffering. Because suffering is one of the few things in life strong enough to displace our imperial egos and say, Lord, take my wounds, take my discouragement, take my disappointment. Don't let me get cynical or bitter. And don't let me transmit this pain to others, but transform it in the belly of the whale. Because it's only when you get to the edge of your own resources and understanding, you learn to lean in to that deeper resource, the God of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. And you see, Hebrews was written for a people who were cynical. The everyday miracles weren't coming. They prayed that the Roman Empire would be dismantled. It didn't happen. But Hebrews says, in your place of discouragement, fall into Jesus, because then you'll see transformation. It's in the belly of the whale you discover the power of those prophetic words in Isaiah 45. I'll give you treasure in the dark place, riches stored in the secret place, to know that I am the Lord. I summon you by name. So maybe God is calling you to stay in that hard place where you don't have all the answers, but you're prepared to be the one that God uses to bring about transformation. Ken Newell stood in that place where at times he was misunderstood by both sides, but he saw peace come in his own time. Mary, the mother of Jesus, stood in that place. She stood at the cross watching her son die. She didn't wallow in agony. She didn't wail or protest, but she stood there in complete solidarity with the mystery of life and death and resurrection. Richard Rohr writes about Mary, it's as if she's saying there's something deeper happening here. How can I absorb it just as Jesus is absorbing it instead of returning it in kind? Consider the analogy of energy circuits. Most of us are relay stations. Only a minority are the transformers, people who actually change the electrical charge passing through us. Jesus on the cross and Mary standing beneath the cross are classic images of transformative spirituality. They don't return the hostility, the hatred, the accusations, the malice directed at them. They hold the suffering until it becomes resurrection. This is what our country here needs today. People who are prepared to sit in the belly of the whale where it's smelly and messy, but they're prepared to sit there and wait for reconciliation and resurrection to come. Don't you hunger for this? People who will move far beyond our comfortable zones and stand in the gap to push back the darkness and say, Lord, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do today? Because I'm prepared to do it in your will and in your way. Maybe you are that person who've been standing there for a long time in the gap, trying to push back the darkness. But in standing there, you've had a few blows dealt on you and you feel wounded today, we would love to pray with you to enable you to stay. Here I am. I'm going to stay in this place, Lord God, until I see transformation. What do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? Yesterday, council was having retreat together and we were talking about what it takes to be a place of welcome. And we were talking about the agony of waiting and how hard it can be to stand with arms open, being vulnerable, waiting for transformation to take place. And someone talked about that verse in a hymn, "Have thine own way, Lord, have thine own way. You are the potter, do you know it? I am the mould me and make me after your will. While I am waiting, yield it and still." God is the potter, we are the clay. So have your way, Lord, in our lives today.